Welcome back to Health Link On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. I'm Linda Cohen. Well, it's estimated that 8 million Americans have an eating disorder, with one in every 200 American women suffering from anorexia and 2 to 3 in 100 American women suffering from bulimia. Eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness, and 95% of those who have eating disorders are between the ages of 12 and 25. Now, these are staggering statistics, and anyone who's faced them can't help but wonder how to help those who suffer from this debilitating problem. Well, joining me this morning to share her own perspective with us is Harriet Brown, an assistant professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University's Newhouse School of Public Communications, who has nearly 30 years of experience as both a writer and a magazine editor. She's written for the New York Times, Red Book, and the Chicago Tribune, just to name a few. And her newest book is called Brave Girl Eating, A Family Struggle with Anorexia, and it's currently out in paperback. Welcome, Professor Brown. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, clearly you've had your own story. Tell us about what your story was with anorexia.
Well, it struck our older daughter, and who was, you know, a bright, outgoing, athletic girl. And we noticed some problems, but we didn't connect them with eating disorders because the first things we saw were anxiety, crying for no reason. She was just 14. You know, she's our oldest, and we kind of thought, well, maybe this is the onset of adolescence and not some pathological situation. But I think, like many people, I had some misconceptions about anorexia. So I thought, to have it, you had to have lost a lot of weight. Well, she hadn't lost weight. It turned out that she hadn't gained weight when she should have, which I didn't realize was as much of an issue. But after a few weeks, it quickly became clear that we were dealing with anorexia, and
How did that happen? How did it become clear? I think that's very important, because you were just talking about symptoms that wouldn't necessarily lead someone to think about an eating disorder. Were there things that did lead you in that direction?
There were a couple things. One was, like I said, she became much more anxious. I had never thought of her as an anxious kid. And her anxiety began to take strange forms. Like, she called me at work on a Monday and wanted to know what we were having for dinner on Friday. And when I said, I don't even know what we're having tonight, she freaked out. Or, you know, she got very excited and asked for a subscription to Gourmet magazine. She said she wanted to cook a dinner for 30 people. This was a kid who had never wanted to bake cookies with me, let alone do any cooking.
So there was this preoccupation with food and eating. So that was some kind of a signal to you.
That definitely was, and it's a very common signal, too. At the same time, I started to notice that she was avoiding actually eating. And the sort of moment of recognition came at her eighth grade graduation. So when you see someone every day, you don't necessarily notice small changes, but when my husband and I saw her from across a room full of other 14-year-olds, we realized how thin she was. And it turned out she had lost maybe 4 or 5 pounds, but she was already so thin. You know, and she'd always been naturally thin. So again, it's like all these little things. And then we really started to pay attention, and then it became very clear as we started to push her a little. Come on, have something to eat. Oh, no. And then out came the excuses, and then we knew.
So what did you do? What was the first thing you did?
We went to our pediatrician, who we loved and still love, and got a diagnosis. And she was very gentle with us. And she basically said, you know, you need to find a therapist and you need to try to get her to eat, which we were already doing without any luck. And then we embarked on trying to find a therapist, and we went through a process. It's not easy. There aren't that many therapists. And honestly, there aren't that many good therapists. You can be an eating, you can treat eating disorders from so many different perspectives, psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, whatever. So we didn't have great success, and meanwhile, our daughter was continuing to diminish.
That must have been very frightening.
It is the worst feeling in the world for a parent. You know, and, you know, I think it's very common for people to say, I don't understand, why don't you just eat? And I'm sure that I said that to her, and I'm sure that I thought that many times. And it took me a long time to understand why she couldn't just eat. So being a science journalist, I started researching and found another approach, which is ultimately what we decided to use.
What was that?
It's called family-based treatment, FBT. It's also more popularly known as the Maudsley approach. And it grew out of family therapists at the Maudsley Hospital in London, which is where the name sort of came from, who observed inpatients on an eating disorders ward, and they watched how the nurses on the ward got these patients to eat by sitting with them, by rubbing their backs, by praising them, and by basically creating an environment where they couldn't not eat. They had to eat. And they thought, you know, and they also noticed how disruptive it was, even in a situation like that, to bring a young teenager into a hospital. It's terrible for everyone, no matter how great the hospital.
So the point was that even though their methodologies might have been working in that setting, the setting alone really flew in the face of success because it was so unnatural in a way to be in a hospital.
And it's scary. And, you know, especially young kids with eating disorders are terrified. At one point, we were advised to send our daughter away, and she just panicked. No, don't send me away. You know, and I didn't really want to send her away.
Of course not.
So these therapists began to think about what would families need in order to make this work at home, which was a huge paradigm shift because families, like with autism and schizophrenia, families have often been blamed as the source of these illnesses. And
exactly.
So,
I mean, that's the thing that strikes me right off the bat. Clearly, they look at the family as psychogenic.
Exactly.
As being the origin. It's mom's fault, it's the family's fault, and clearly we do know that there are strong cultural contributors, but it seemed way off base to blame the family when the family should be the place to find the cure, I think.
Well, and so what these therapists said was, look, we don't really know what causes eating disorders, and that's true. We have a lot more ideas now, and a lot of it is, you know, there's a strong neurobiological basis, but we don't really know. Let's put that aside, because that's really not helping, because treatment recovery statistics are terrible. So, hey, what we're doing isn't working. Let's try something else. And what are the assets that an adolescent has? Ooh, they have their family. How can we use the family? So Maudsley therapists say they're agnostic about cause. And sure, there are pathological families. There are dysfunctional families. But my personal feeling is if family dysfunction caused eating disorders, those numbers you read at the beginning would be much, much higher.
I would agree there.
So they said, how can, you know, who cares the most about what happens to a child, family? Who's there with a child? You know, you can be the greatest therapist in the world, and you see someone once or twice or three times a week, but they have to sit at the table six times a day. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the kid needs support and the right kind of pressure and guidance.
That's what strikes me, though, this issue of the right kind of pressure. Because clearly you would think, it seems to me that somebody is refusing to eat, and it may be an issue of control, or just they have no control over this one thing they're dealing with, and you start to pressure, you would almost think it would have the a reverse reaction, that they would basically even dig their heels in further or harder.
Well, they do, but it's not because, you know, those are some of the, the idea that eating disorders are about control. There's really no basis for that. What we're coming to understand is the strong neurobiology. It's looking, through experiments being done out at UC San Diego and elsewhere with functional MRI scanners on people with anorexia and who are long recovered from it. The new working hypothesis is that people who develop eating disorders are wired differently from birth. There's disturbances in their serotonin and dopamine systems. Their insula doesn't work the right way, so they don't experience reward and punishment the way people who don't have eating disorders do. So there's this kind of underlying fundamental difference in their neurobiology, and then we live in a very triggering culture where people cannot stop talking about food, eating, weight, where we have elevated thinness to, you know, the level of a god. And so I think if you've got this underlying vulnerability, of course it's going to get triggered here.
That makes a lot of sense. So what did you do?
Well, we basically, the first thing is we did not treat it like a punishment. You know, we framed it, and obviously she couldn't really hear that at that point, but it was important for us and for her later. We're not asking you to eat to punish you. We know that this is very scary. We tried to be empathetic, but firm. And an analogy I like to use is if you had a young child with cancer and they had to go through chemotherapy, of course they wouldn't want to do it because it makes you sick, it makes you feel bad. And you as the parent would have to find a way. And you would frame it the same way. Yeah, this is terrible. This is the worst thing you've ever had to do, and I really see that. But you have to do it because there's no other way through this illness. And I'm right here with you, and I'm going to help you as best as I can. And here, let's watch a movie while we eat. Or, you know, you do, every child is different, which is why I think parents are the best asset. You know your kid. You know what's going to help them, and you're right there to switch gears when you need to.
So besides your own natural native talent for this, which it sounds like you came by it more naturally, is there a protocol that parents can actually adopt? And let's say they wanted to use this type of training to help their child.
Well, we were not lucky in the sense that there are very few therapists trained in this modality. There are more and more. There's now a training institute in the U.S. through the University of Chicago and Stanford, a joint program. So really what I would say, and in fact, I created a website with another mom, maudsleyparents.org, and part of what we've got on there is a list of treatment providers who have been trained.
Can you spell Maudsley?
M-A-U-D-S-L-E-Y.
Great.
And so my first suggestion would be, don't try to do it the way we did it. Try to, you know, if you're working with a trained therapist, they really help with that. Although I will say that a big chunk of the treatment is no one is going to tell you exactly what to do. And parents can find that very frustrating. I want you to fix my kid. Tell me how to fix my kid. And people have often asked me, so you were already trying to get her to eat and it didn't work. And then you switched gears and then it did work. What happened? And the real key is that I felt empowered. Not only did I feel empowered, like, oh, now I could do this. Because before that, everyone was telling me, back off, mom. Don't talk about the food. It's not about the food. It's a control issue. It's this. It's that. Maybe she was sexually abused. Maybe this. But whatever. She'll eat when she's ready. No, she'll die before she'll eat. That was really the bottom line. And so not only did I feel like it's okay for us to do this, but I realized we had to do it. No one else was going to do it for us, and she was not going to eat of her own volition.
And you were successful is the bottom line.
We were successful. It was a grueling process, but honestly, it was less grueling for us to go through that than to just watch her starve.
So she's faring well right now.
She's well. She did have a relapse. She recovered in about a year. She had to gain a lot of weight because she was growing at the time and things were changing. She relapsed when she went and lived on her own at 18, but she is very well now.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. So what is this something that you mentioned before the break about Project Body Talk? In just very little bit of time we have left, can you tell us what that is?
Yes, it's a web-based audio commentary. I love audio. I love hearing people's real voices talk about their feelings. So it's projectbodytalk.com. People have recorded audio commentaries about how they feel about their own bodies, weight, eating, other people, the culture, and that you can record and upload it yourself. You can.
And what's the goal?
The goal is so that people don't feel alone, so people know, hey, other people are dealing with this.
Well, that's incredible. And clearly the book will help a lot of people out there, I think, as you recount your story. And it's inspirational, actually. I think you've really hit on a very, very, you know, poignant chord in our society. Well, Harriet Brown, Syracuse University Professor of Journalism and author of the new book, Brave Girl Eating. Thanks so much for coming in. Really, really enjoyed talking to you on this very poignant subject. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back, so please stay right there. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.